British Antarctic Survey Archives. Oral History Recording Number 2. Captain V.A. Marchese. A recording of Captain Marchese, commanding officer of HMS William Scoresby between 1943 and 1946. In conversation with Miss Joanna Ray, Assistant Archivist of the British Antarctic Survey. Date 13th of August 1986. Location National Maritime Museum, Greenwich. Captain Marchese, could you give me an outline of your career before your involvement with Operation Taboo?
Yes, I started, if you like to call it, my seagoing career by going to, as a cadet, to the training ship Worcester at Greenhithe in Kent. When I left Worcester, I became a midshipman R&R, and I joined a shipping company called T&J Brocklebanks of Liverpool. And I was with them for 3 years, during which time I did some R&R training as a midshipman. And at the end of my 3 years, I sat for my second mate certificate, which I obtained in early 1934. This was during the time of the Depression, and I eventually went back to sea as a fourth mate in Brocklebanks, which I did for a year. I then left and to do my R&R training as an acting sub-lieutenant. And during my training, I met a chap called Boothby, who was actually in command of the Royal Research Ship William Scoresby. And I was talking to him, and I said, I suppose everybody in your outfit has to have a master's ticket. And he said, oh no, not necessarily. However, I never thought anything more of it until when I'd finished my R&R training, I went up to the Admiral Commanding Reserves office, and which was in a building in, I think it was called Queen Anne somewhere or other, just off Victoria Street. And as I came down from having seen the Admiral Commanding Reserves office, I noticed on the board was the Discovery Committee. And I went in and saw the secretary and asked him whether there was any jobs going, in which he replied, if you like, give me your name and address. We haven't got anything at the present moment, but we'll put it on the record. About 4 weeks later, I was got a letter asking me whether I'd like to be considered for the job of second officer of the Royal Research Ship William Scoresby. I went up for an interview, and at the end of the interview, I went out with another chap who I knew who was also out for an interview for the same job, and we came to the conclusion that neither of us had got the job. About a fortnight later, I got a letter to say that I hadn't got the job, and very soon after that, I got another letter from them saying, would I like to go as fourth officer of the Royal Research Ship Discovery 2? And I said yes, and cut a long story short, I got the job in Discovery 2 as fourth officer, and my friend who we had gone out together after the interview actually got the job as second officer at the William Scoresby. And that is my connection with first experience of the Antarctic.
How long did you go south for with that ship?
Well, we were away 15 months. Mm-hmm. And at the end of my time there, this was in 1937, the Admiralty has started taking merchant R&R officers mm-hmm. into the RN. And at my age, I was only then 23, mm-hmm. It was the obvious thing for me to do, so I transferred to the RN from the RNR, and after doing my courses as a sub-lieutenant, I eventually specialised in hydrographic surveying and went to a surveying ship. After that, my career was rather the same as any other naval officer's, except that in 1943, I was first lieutenant of a surveying ship called HMS Franklin, and we were surveying on the east coast of England. And we got a signal to say that I had to report. I was to report to a Mr., I think the name was Moxham, in the military department of the Admiralty. I hadn't the vaguest idea what it was all about, nor did my captain. And so I reported to, I went up to London and went and saw this Mr. Moxham, who told me about Operation Tavern, which at that particular time had no name whatsoever, and that I would, if I went to a certain address, or rather, I would meet, did I know Jimmy Marr? That was it, first thing. I said, yes, I did know Jimmy Marr, because he'd been in Discovery 2 with me. So he said, well, he is going to run this expedition, and he has asked for you, and the best thing to do is to go and see him. He'll be arriving at Waterloo, I think it was, with his wife at about whatever time it was. He was coming up from his home in Hampshire. Well, I met him on the station, and he told me more or less all about it. And my first words were, well, what about a ship? And he said, well, they've got a sealer called the Vesla Kari, and it was a wooden ship, and he said he thought it was suitable for the job. And that it was then in dry dock in London, being prepared for the expedition.
What time of the year was this?
This would have been in about June. Might have been July, I can't. June, July. It might have even been earlier. But anyway, he said that he had an office in part of the then colonial office, and there's himself and a chap called Berry. Now, Berry had been chief steward of Discovery 2, and he was helping Jimmy Marr with the stores required for the expedition, and that I would have an office there as well. So I went to this office and so forth, and all was well. I went down to the ship. She was a funny little wooden ship. They removed some of the greenheart planking and said that they thought she was sound. She had an engine. She was schooner rigged, and she had a small engine, which they said they could get 6 knots out of. I had my doubt about this, but I hadn't anything to say. And I had been told by the military department that the ship was unsatisfactory at this particular moment, they would produce a minesweeper to take place. I had no reason to suspect that she wouldn't be suitable, so we went on with everything. The then hydrographer of the Navy, Admiral Edgell, said, you be careful of these wooden ships. And he said, I have had experience of them years ago. But anyway, that was beside the point. And eventually, we had various committee meetings in which all kinds of things were brought up, mainly personnel. and the time was rapidly approaching when all the stores which were gradually accruing, and the Veslicari was renamed HMS Bransfield, and some officers were appointed, and a crew who and in due course, this must have been in September, everybody came aboard the HMS Bransfield, and we sailed from London. I should say, amongst the people going down south was a chap called Jock Matheson, who I'd known in Discovery 2, who was a seaman, and he was a very good sailor. He had been bosun of Discovery 1 in the Banzoriland expedition, and he, on the way out, was going to be my sailing master. However, we got down to Tilbury and we were told to sail in a convoy to Falmouth. We were going into Falmouth. It was a 6-knot convoy, so we thought we might be able to keep up with it. The senior officer of the escort was a French captain, commanding officer of a French destroyer, who thought HMS Bransfield was a hunt class destroyer, which didn't was not so. Anyway, we sailed. And we got clear of the downs, by which time the convoy was just over the horizon. We had something wrong, I can't remember what it was now, offhand. And we went into Portsmouth.
Were you concerned by this time?
Oh yes, I was getting a bit concerned. We went into Portsmouth. And they did what repairs there were, and we went on to Weymouth. Now, on the way to Weymouth, the engineman who looked after the engines came up and said that we were making water, and he didn't know where it was coming from. So I put into Weymouth, and we pumped all the water out, and as we were supposed to be top secret, nobody knew anything about us very much, but they did in Falmouth. The NOIC Falmouth knew all about us. Mm-hmm. And so the obvious thing to do was to make Falmouth. Well, we sailed from Weymouth for Falmouth. I remember we got off Falmouth at about 8 o'clock in the evening. It was dark. The engineman came up and said he'll have to stop the engines because he hadn't got enough steam for the pumps. And we eventually got into Falmouth. And Jimmy Marr and I went and saw NOIC Falmouth, and then we went up to London to meet the committee who had originally been responsible for the expedition, or still were, I suppose, indirectly. And they said, well, you can't get a minesweeper because there isn't one available now. So that was knocked that one on the head. And so it was eventually decided to use the William Scoresby, which was actually in the Falkland Islands at the time. And the expedition would go out by a passenger ship, or an ideal trooper, in the Highland Monarch, which we did do, and we eventually arrived in Stanley. Now, I should point out that I was originally appointed second in command of the expedition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, under Marr.
Yeah.
And the object of this was two partly twofold. One, he knew me and I knew him, which was, he didn't know hardly any of the others, which was one thing. The second thing was that if I was up in Stanley, I could interpret what he was trying to, if he made a signal to Stanley and there were stores or anything like that, I could deal with it. And this is roughly the idea. Mm-hmm. So off we got to Stanley. We met, the governor met us, the naval officer in charge, and...
How much had they been told about
it? The governor knew all about it, because it was partly his idea, so he said. Now, that was a very nice chap called Sir Alan Wolsey Cardinal. Mm-hmm. He was a dear old boy. And the first two nights, Jimmy Marr and I slept at Government House. And then the next day I went to Scoresby. Now, there was trouble as far as the Scoresby was concerned, because you had hardly any room to carry stores. In fact, you had no room, really. So, as the object of the, as far as we were concerned, was supposed to be showing sovereign rights over the territory, it really didn't make a lot of difference, providing they got there. Mm. And I went around putting up flags here, there and everywhere. So the Fitzroy, which was a ship which belonged to the Falkland Island Company, was, if you like to call it, chartered. Mm-hmm. And that they took the stores, and most of the people who were going to be at the bases. And we sailed in convoy together down to Deception Island. We got to Deception Island, and I went in first just in case there was an Argentine ship there, which it wasn't. And we got in, and we unloaded the stores for Deception and set up the base in one of the huts there. Mm-hmm. And then we went off to the next place we were going to was Hope Bay. So we sailed in convoy to Hope Bay. Now we got off Hope Bay and there was pack ice in the bay and outside, and the Fitzroy would not go in, of course. So I went in Scoresby, with Jimmy Marr on board, and we got into Hope Bay, looked around, Fitzroy wouldn't come in, so we said, right, it is no good using Hope Bay at the present moment. So even if I could have ferried the stores in, which I doubt very much whether I would have been able to.
Did you feel that Fitzroy had made the right decision?
Yes, well, the Fitzroy was a commercial ship, and one couldn't afford to lose her, I suppose, really, if she got hold in ice. Mm. And so we sailed from Hope Bay, and we went around all the bays on the western side of the Graham Land Peninsula, starting off. We never found anywhere else, and then eventually we decided to use Port La Croix. And we went into Port La Croix and we built a hut there. We landed the store, we built a hut there, and as it was beginning to get later in the season, obviously time was, one couldn't keep on going to look for places. Mm. And so we put up the hut there, and the Fitzroy sailed, and I think I stayed, and went to Deception Island. And also, we Jimmy Marr, we wanted to go further south and put a mark up, or, i.e. A Union Jack, on a point. I can't remember the point now. But it was not all that further south.
Cape Leonard, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
And off we went. And it was a beautiful day, I remember. We went down the channel, and it was beautiful.
Mm.
It's one of these beautiful Antarctic days. Blue sky, sun shining, the snow. Oh, it's wonderful.
Mm.
And unfortunately, on the way to Cape Renard, there was a lot of snow-covered, small snow-covered islands.
Mm.
They weren't very large, you know, sort of some only about 40 or 50 feet long, and so, but just snow covered. And we went to Cape Renard, we put up the flag and everything, and everybody re-embarked in the ship, and we were returning to Port Macquarie. Jimmy Marr asked me whether he could have a bath. And so I said, yes, by all means, have a bath, you know. Had to be salt water, but that was beside the point. And so he went, he was having a bath as we were coming along, and I was on the bridge, and the officer of the watch leaning over the side, and there was a few bits of ice hanging around, not very much. And I saw ahead what looked like a piece of ice. I didn't pay a great deal of attention. And suddenly the officer of the watch leant over the side and said, my God, I can see the bottom. Just then there was an awful clang where we hit the bottom, rock. Luckily we weren't going very far. Now Jimmy Marr was in the middle of his bath, a lovely hot salt water bath, and this clang, he thought, my God, the ship's sinking. He came rushing up in his birthday suit up to the bridge. Anyway, there was no damage done, and we got back to Port Macquarie. I then returned to Stanley.
Leaving them for the winter?
Then I came down, I came again in April. I can't remember the exact dates now. Unfortunately, I haven't got a copy of my reports of proceedings, but it was certainly in April. I went down south again. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Sorry. I then went on to the South Orkney Islands. We looked around the South Orkney and then went on up to South Georgia. And refueled in South Georgia and returned to Stanley. Then I went south again with really mail and stores for all the bases. And having left all the mail and what stores I had for them at both Deception and Port Macquarie, I said goodbye to winter and came back to Stanley. Now, the Scoresby had a 12-pounder gun on up for it, and the ship was going to go to Montevideo to refit. And I managed to get the Admiralty to agree to removing the 12-pounder gun because I couldn't really see what the benefit of a 12-pounder gun was going to be down there. And even if I'd met the Argentines, they'd probably had larger guns than that. And we caused a bit of a commotion in Montevideo because when we arrived up there, we also had some depth charges. And we remove the pistols and so forth, but unfortunately, on unloading these things, one went to the bottom of the harbour. You see, and the panic. And I said, "Well, there's nothing to panic about. Just get a diver to go down, hook it on, and bring it up. It won't go." Anyway, this went on for about 3 days, and eventually, at great expense of the British Embassy, and including 2 bottles of brandy for the diver, he was hooked on and brought back, and nothing happened. I should tell you that the ambassador in Montevideo, a bloke called Gordon Verica, says that in his biography, he's going to head one of the chapters, The Bomb. Anyway, we refitted and we went back to Stanley. When we were in Stanley, we did odd jobs like going around the island.
Doing mail deliveries?
Well, not mail deliveries, just helping out, you know. And then we, in 1 October, a number of new people came out for the bases. And we sailed, if I remember rightly, in November. I got down, I suppose, about 100 miles off the South Shetland Islands, and we met pack ice. Mm-hmm. I started going through it, and then I decided it was too heavy. It really wasn't worth it at that stage, because I couldn't see anywhere. Mm-hmm. So we turned around and went back to Stanley. Waited 10 days, and then went south again, mm-hmm. which time we found pack ice was clear, and I went to Deception and Port LaCroix. Now, because of it being difficult to get into Port LaCroix, and not Port LaCroix, Hope Bay, mm-hmm. they chartered a Newfoundland ship called the Eagle, commanded by a chap called Shepherd. And they came down just about towards the end of November, when I was already down south.
So you didn't have any liaison?
Oh yes, we did. But she came to Stanley. Mm-hmm. She was in Stanley whilst I was still south. Now, at this particular time, Jimmy Marr wasn't very well. And it was decided that he had to come home.
Mm-hmm. What was wrong with him?
Well, I never, you know, he complained about various pains here, there and everywhere. In retrospect, I know what it was. It was only, I think it was the beginning of the cancer which killed him, in actual fact. Mm. But that's some years later. Mm. Anyway, he came back, I brought him back, and he came home, and Captain Taylor, the Royal Canadian Engineer, took command of the expedition, and it was already been decided that Hope Bay would be set up. And the Eagle came out specially to do this, really. Mm. So the stores were loaded in the Eagle. I can't remember whether she went to Port LaCroix or not. I don't think she did. She may have done, but I don't think she did. And of course I think I brought everybody up to Port LaCroix, and everybody swapped around. And we went back to the Eagle then went and set up Hope Bay. I was in Hope Bay with the Eagle for some time, not very long, and then I returned to Stanley. I'd no sooner got back to Stanley, I'd been back in Stanley about a few days, mm-hmm. when we got a signal to say that the Eagle had hit an iceberg and was in danger. Mm-hmm. So I went down south and to escort her back. I met her off the South Shetlands, and she had hit a berg, which had carved off the barrier there. And the And I think it had been blowing quite hard, and she dragged her anchors. And
was it a dangerous bay to anchor?
It wasn't a very good anchorage. Mm. It's like all the bays in the, or I won't say all of them, but a large percentage of them. Mm. A very deep water, and you were never quite certain what the holding ground was going to be like. And of course, in a ship, the deeper the water, the more difficult it is to, if you're using anchors, for the ship to hold. And it wasn't all that good, really.
Do you know why they decided on Hope Bay beforehand?
It was decided on Hope Bay because they reckoned you could get inland from there. Mm. The shore parties would be able to sledge from there. You couldn't sledge from Port Macquarie, and of course you couldn't sledge from Deception. But you could, and Norgan Shoal, I think I'm right in saying, was wrecked, got to Hope Bay, and then sledged to Snow Hill Island in the Weddell Sea. So you could sledge from there, and this is really what that was the reason of Hope Bay. And we then at Hope Bay, the Eagle having returned, I went down there again, and Russell wanted me to Taylor. Wanted me to go down to Snow Hill Island in the Weddell Sea. Unfortunately, at that particular time, I was having boiler trouble. And I didn't really think it was a very wise thing to do, to go down the Weddell Sea at that particular time of the year to Snow Hill Island, just drop some stores off and return, especially as it was in that vicinity, or not far from there. The Endeavour got crushed. So, anyway, I didn't. And I went on to the South Orkney Islands, where I put up a hut on Sydney Island. And we this was quite successful as far as putting it up. Whether the hut was a good place to live in, I don't know, because nobody was going to live in it.
What was the purpose of it?
Again, showing sovereignty. I then went back to Stanley. I'm getting a bit mixed up now. Okay, I then went back to the South Orkney Islands and went to the Argentine Met Base. And I arrived there before their own relief ship. And I was on the southern side of the isthmus. And when I got there, I went ashore with a sheep, or the carcass of a sheep, and a bottle of whiskey, which I thought might, because they'd been there all winter. They met me, they were delighted with the sheep. They had more than enough whiskey, they said that I kept my bottle. And they presented us with some penguin eggs, and told us that they were pleased to see us because their own ship hadn't got through because of ice, so they said. We couldn't quite understand it, but that was beside the point. Anyway, the next day, about 48 hours later, this Argentine naval ship came in, or transport, and I made a signal to him, asking the commanding officer to come and call on me. Nothing happened. I was still trying to show, acts of sovereignty. Anyway, they sailed, that was it, and so did I.
So they didn't approach you?
No. The Met people, yes, but not the... And I went back to went up to South Georgia, and from South Georgia I went back to Stanley. Then I went back down south again. Oh yes, they needed another man in Deception Island. And he decided to, he wanted one as a cook. And so we thought we'd get somebody from the Falklands to do this. And we had a committee of, an interview committee, which consisted of the naval officer in charge, a chap called Hamilton, who was officially, he was the Marine, he was a government biologist, and also the magistrate of Stanley, and Uncle Tom Copley and all, and myself. Hamilton, I should explain, had been down south in Discovery, I think he'd been in Discovery 1, in actual fact. We selected somebody, which I wasn't all that keen on, but the other two were, and he came south. And
was this Sam Bomber?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he, as you know, he had to be, we couldn't relieve it, get him back in the winter.
And he became ill, didn't he?
Yes, he had cancer.
Did he? Oh,
and he'd been medically examined well beforehand. And afterwards, Hamilton said to me, he said, I thought there was something wrong with that man. Anyway, that's the subject. Anyway, and that ended that year, really, as far as I was concerned. I went back to eventually I went to Montevideo, and again refitted. And whilst I was there, I got a signal. Well, we got a signal, the British Embassy got a signal, saying that a chap called Mine was coming out. And I thought it had been a coded message or in cipher, and I thought it was Ma coming back again. And Ted Bingham. Anyway, the British ambassador said to me, well, look, you better meet them. And he said, they're going to be sent, they're going to come here. That was the embassy. And he said, you come meet them. So I went and met them in the morning. And it was Ted Bingham, who I knew before anyway. And I looked after them after that, or took them under my wing. And we were then waiting for the Trapassi to come down, which was a little ship which had taken the place of the Eagle. And again, commanded by Shepherd, who had been in command of the Eagle. And they brought a lot of dogs down. And all was happy, except that the dogs stank to my heaven, because they had been fed on seal meat, and something, it must have gone rotten, I thought. Anyway, they then went on to Stanley, I went on to Stanley, during which time the Scoresby had been chewed, boilers.
So that solved the boiler problem?
Yeah, well, not quite, because they couldn't get the right sort of tubes for that. And say this was wartime, you've got to remember, the war was over then. But we went down south and started relieving the bases, because Ted Bingham brought out a completely new crowd of people. And it was then known as the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. And we relieved the bases, and the capacity helped set up. We did a lot of relieving one way or the other. Of Trapassi and ourselves, we worked in conjunction. And then, of course, they set up another base down south at Marguerite Bay. Mm-hmm. And that really, until about April, was the story of the William Scoresby, because after that, I bought the Scoresby home.
Mm-hmm.
And she went back to the Discovery Committee, or when I say Discovery, or Discovery Investigations. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, she sailed once more, but I don't think she ever really went south.
Mm-hmm.
She did some whaling, scientific work in whaling, but I think it was mainly around South Africa.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was the end of the Scoresby, as far as I know. The only amusing thing I think about it is I'm expecting a grandson before long, or it will be my fourth grandchild, mm-hmm. and my eldest son, for some unknown reason, wants to call it William Scoresby. I don't know whether this is different.
Well, I think that's a good time to stop
okay.
for this half. Could you tell me about the organisation of the expedition?
Yes, there was a committee which was headed over by a man called Atchison, who was an assistant secretary in the colonial service,
mm-hmm.
or in the colonial office. On the committee was James Wordy, who had been with Shackleton. There was a representative from the Admiralty, who was a civilian. There was Dr. McIntosh from the Discovery Investigations. There was another couple of representatives from the Colonial Office, or rather, I should say, Crown agents, more than
mm-hmm.
anything. Jimmy Marr and myself. And we used to meet, usually at least once a week, if not twice a week, depending on the what was required. Now, stores and so forth were obtained through the services, i.e. mainly the Navy. One or two bits came from the Army as well. For instance, I got hauled over the coals by the hydrographer, who got in touch with me and sort of said, "What's this list of surveying equipment you ordered? We don't have half of this stuff. I don't even know what it is." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I haven't put in..." And I found it was Captain Taylor's surveying equipment, which was mainly based on land surveyor.
Mm-hmm.
And this had to be obtained from elsewhere. I should point out that the theodolites he had, which were German make, were very good indeed, much better than we had in the surveying study. Well, that is, and when the ship sailed, I still believe they used to meet, but obviously not so often, and to discuss how things were going. The hydrographer of the Navy had a great interest in it, although he wasn't actually on the committee. But obviously he had probably other things to do, I don't know. But that is mainly about how it was organized. I would like to say that Jimmy Moore had a lot, did a hell of a lot for it, and I was rather, I always felt that poor old Jimmy Moore really didn't get quite the recognition he deserved, really.
Because presumably he had to decide all the stores that were needed, where they were needed.
In fact, when I first met him, we went into the office, and he had sheets and sheets of foolscap of stores that were required. Mm.
Do you know why he was selected as the leader?
I don't know. I think, you see, Jimmy Moore, I don't know if you know his... Jimmy Moore went down south originally. He was Scout Moore of Shackleton's last expedition in whenever it was, 1919-1920. And when he came back, of course that was the expedition Shackleton died on, when he came back, he eventually went to Aberdeen University and took degrees in marine biology, I think, or zoology. And he then joined the Discovery Investigations as a scientist. Now, he also went on the Banzari Land expedition with Mawson. And I would have said, probably, he was quite well known as an Antarctic explorer. I don't think he really knew a great deal about the land side of it, but he certainly did about the seaside. But that is the only reason I can think that they select him. I know, for instance, myself, I was about the third on the list, I think, of people who were requested. I know that one of them was, what's his name? Colbeck, who had been on Banzai Land expedition in Discovery 1. He was one of the ones suggested. And I think the only reason I was actually selected was because I was a hydrographic surveyor, although I didn't really do any surveying there, although I was supposed to, but the opportunity just didn't exist. And but that's besides the point.
Were you pleased that you were selected?
Oh, yes, yes. I must confess that I've always... I've put it this way. This is really something at the bottom here.
Ah, right. Perhaps we'll ask the next question.
Yeah.
Were you conscious of changes about the bases when you returned after the winter season? And what kind of changes did you notice?
Well, strangely it may seem, yes, there was always a certain amount. When you got there, you... after all, the chaps have been there in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And up to a point, sometimes you felt there was a certain amount of friction going on between various people. Now, this is understandable after 6 months with nothing else, not a great deal to do, possibly. And but generally speaking, I don't think... they were always pleased to see you, if you know what I mean. I say the fact that you came, one bought mail,
yes,
and could take their mail back, which was a very important thing in actual fact. That was one thing. Other thing was you bought fresh stores for them, fresh food, if nothing else. In some cases, you even bought something to drink one way or another, because like everybody else, they used to have a tot of rum from time to time. And one could talk about things. But in lots of cases, the places were... When you left them in the summer, when you got back after the winter, was the place was looking so neat and tidy,
yes,
and everybody seemed to get on extremely well.
Because, for instance, after leaving Hope Bay, having just established it, it must have looked a complete tip, nearly.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And a lot of the stuff was still as it was originally, covered over by a tarpaulin and probably now then weighted down by snow. But the place itself was... I should also say, I think this is one of the... I think this is one of the amusing things, is that when I relieved Hope Bay, when they were coming home, I went down, I got held up by ice, and eventually got clear of it and got into Hope Bay. And I arrived there at about 5 o'clock in the morning. And as I steamed into Hope Bay, I blew my whistle and so forth and so forth. Nothing happened. No, not a sign. And I went, we anchored, and I said to my first lieutenant, well, I'll go ashore and see what's happening up there. I went there, and I got in, got to the hut, nobody there, I opened the door, everybody was sound asleep. So I shouted, wakey, wakey, don't some of you so-and-sos want to go home? And they, my God!
It was lovely.
It was lovely, yeah. It really was, it was quite...
Because I expect you were expecting quite a reception when you came in with the whistle.
Well, I was hoping that, you know, they might be... But, you see, they said afterwards that they had been expecting me the day before, or a couple of days before. Then they heard I was held up by ice. They thought, oh, my God, you know. And then when I did, of course, arrive, it was a sort of slight anticlimax.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah. Could you describe something of the nature and problems of sailing in those latitudes?
Well, there's one of the problems of in those days, I'll say in those days, because I would have thought in this modern day and age it's much more simple. But in my time down there, when after all the only navigation gear I had in the ship was a compass, which was a magnetic compass, and an echo sounding machine, which didn't work properly. And that was about all. And obviously I had sextants and so forth. But you had to worry, A, about icebergs in the at night, if you were in a vicinity where there were bergs around, and you can never tell whether there wasn't a berg around. It wasn't so bad on a moonlight night, but on a very dark night, you really had to ease down at times. Of course, you get very bad weather down going through the 40s and 50s. In the Southern Ocean, and this can again be very, very uncomfortable. For instance, in my cabin in William Scoresby, on one occasion I had about a foot of water and sloughing around in it for about 3 days. And then on top of that, you've got no really decent harbour. You probably have in time when one's managed to survey them a bit better, but and you just had to take your chance. And then of course the major thing is a lot of the places, the area wasn't well surveyed at all. You couldn't, I mean, say you quite easily hit a rock which nobody knew was there. And it wasn't marked on the chart and so forth.
Was there any precautions that you could take?
Well, the only precautions you can take is have your echo sound, in those days, have an echo sounder going, or use your knowledge of the Antarctic or the sea to the best of your ability. That is the only way you could deal today with radar and all this sort of business, I mean, they're completely different.
Mm.
You can get your position so accurately. In the, I mean, say, when I was going down south, you may not see the sun or stars for a couple of days, so you just had to rely on dead reckoning.
Mm. Mm.
Nowadays, I mean, say, you can press a button and get your latitude and longitude on the screen.
Mm.
It doesn't matter where you are.
Yes.
So you had all these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, the charts you were using were very inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to, as I say, use your own initiative and judgment and hope that you were going to be right.
Mm-hmm. Was it your first command of the ship?
It was my first command, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a good one,
mm-hmm.
and it was an enjoyable one.
Yeah.
And
I think that leads us neatly on to the next question. Mm. The Scoresby's association with FIDS ended in 1946. Mm. Would you outline your career since then?
Yes, after that, when I came home from FIDS, I asked the hydrographer to go back to general service. And they didn't want to send me back to general service. So they sent me to
explain what that means?
Well, I was a specialist, I didn't want to continue in the surveying service as a hydrographer. And I wanted to go back to general service, what in naval fashion was known as salt horse, i.e. you had no specialisation and you could go anywhere. So the hydrographer appointed me to the Joint Intelligence Bureau as a surveyor, which I was there for 18 months actually, during which time I used to lobby a friend of mine who was the naval assistant to the Second Sea Lord, Mike Townsend, and Mike used to say, well, I'll do what I can for you, but he said, you know, it's very difficult to get you away from Droggy.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually it happened, and Archie Day, in vain effort, offered me a command of a surveying motor launch.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I said, I want to go. So I went. And so I left, I was relieved eventually in the Joint Intelligence Bureau, and I went, I was appointed in command of an ex-German destroyer called HMS Nonsuch. I never actually took command of this, because I was phoned up later, and said that they had the, by Mike Townsend, who said they had the finest job for me, for an operation called Operation Harness.
Oh.
And this was carrying out chemical warfare experiments. That's all I'll say about it. And I did actually have command of HMS Narvik for a time. And then eventually I went on, I was the staff officer to the Commodore for this expedition, for this operation. And that went on for about 18 months,
mm-hmm.
again, 2 years. And then I went and did a staff course. And I then went to the Admiralty. And I didn't do a staff course, I did a tactical course.
Mm-hmm.
I then went to the Admiralty and in the Naval Training Department was the Admiralty Lecturer to Schools and Schools Liaison Officer. And I borrowed from the Discovery Committee, or Discovery Investigations, slides. It was George Deacon's slides. I think it was George Deacon. And I used to use these part of my spiel to schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to show them, you know, sort of what things were like down in the Antarctic, which I thought, get away from this business of firing guns all the time and torpedoes and the war. And it went down reasonably well.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 18 months. I didn't like working in London. And then I was relieved, and I went on leave. I was on leave for about 3 or 4 months. Mm. And I then was appointed first lieutenant of an aircraft carrier during the Korean War. And I was in HMS Unicorn out in the Far East for 2.5 years. Mm. And I then got relieved, came home, and then I went on the staff of CNC Med as SOO2 and Fleet ABCD officer, as it was known as in those days. And I was on the staff there for nearly 3 years. Mm-hmm. Then I came home, and I was then passed over as a 2.5. And I went as staff officer to the Ulster Division of the RNVR, which meant running the RNVR in Ulster, mm-hmm. really, basically. And then I retired from the Navy at the age of 45. Then eventually I got a job with Bass, the Brewers. Yeah. And that was just a shoreside job, mm-hmm. you know, sort of proper shoreside. Mm-hmm. I was made redundant 10 years later. And I then joined Cunard as a port relief officer. Mm-hmm. And from Cunard, eventually when I was 63, they said, you've got to retire now, whether you like it or not. I got a job in the Cuttiff Sark, where I am at the present moment. Mm-hmm. And that's basically my career up to the date.
Is the Cuttiff Sark an HMS ship or not?
No, no.
No.
No, the Cuttiff Sark is, we call her CS, which is stands for Clipper Ship.
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank you very much for that.
All right.